went to the parking lot to assist with rescue efforts. Inside the NMCC, the Deputy Director for Operations called for an all-purpose significant event conference. It began at 9:29 with a brief recap. Two aircraft had struck the World Trade Center. There was a confirmed hijacking of American Flight No. 11, and Otis fighters had been scrambled. The FAA was asked to provide an update, but the line was silent because the FAA had not been added to the call. A minute later, the deputy director stated that it had just been confirmed that American Flight No. 11 was still airborne and heading toward D.C. He directed the transition to an air threat conference call. NORAD confirmed that American Flight No. 11 was airborne and heading toward Washington, relaying the erroneous FAA information already mentioned. The call then ended at about 9:34. It resumed at 9:37 as an air threat conference call, which lasted more than 8 hours. The President, Vice President, Secretary of Defense, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley all participated in this teleconference at various times, as did military personnel from the White House underground shelter and the President's military aide on Air Force One. Operators worked feverishly to include the FAA, but they had equipment problems and difficulty finding secure phone numbers. NORAD asked 3 times before 10:03 to confirm the presence of the FAA in the teleconference. The FAA representative, who finally joined the call at 10:17, had no familiarity with or responsibility for hijackings, no access to decision-makers, and none of the information available to senior FAA officials. We found no evidence that at this critical time, NORAD's top commanders in Florida or Cheyenne Mountain coordinated with their counterparts at FAA headquarters to improve awareness and organize a common response. Lower-level officials improvised. For example, the FAA's Boston Center bypassed the chain of command and directly contacted NEADS after the first hijacking. But the highest-level Defense Department officials relied on the NMCC's air threat conference, in which the FAA did not participate for the first 48 minutes. At 9:39, the NMCC's Deputy Director for Operations, a military officer, opened the call from the Pentagon, which had just been hit. He began, "An air attack against North America may be in progress. NORAD, what's the situation?" NORAD said it had conflicting reports. Its latest information was of a possible hijacked aircraft taking off out of JFK en route to Washington, D.C. The NMCC reported a crash into the mall side of the Pentagon and requested that the Secretary of Defense be added to the conference. At 9:44, NORAD briefed the conference on the possible hijacking of Delta 1989. 2 minutes later, staff reported that they were still trying to locate Secretary Rumsfeld and Vice Chairman Myers. The Vice Chairman joined the conference shortly before 10 o'clock. The Secretary shortly before 10:30. The Chairman was out of the country. At 9:48, a representative from the White House shelter asked if there were any indications of another hijacked aircraft. The Deputy Director for Operations mentioned the Delta flight and concluded that that would be the fourth possible hijack. At 9:49, the commander of NORAD directed all air sovereignty aircraft to battle stations, fully armed. At 9:59, an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel working in the White House military office joined the conference and stated he had just talked to Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. The White House requested 1. Implementation of continuity of government measures, 2. Fighter escorts for Air Force One, and 3. A fighter combat air patrol over Washington, D.C. By 10:03, when United No. 93 crashed in Pennsylvania, there had been no mention of its hijacking, and the FAA had not yet been added to the teleconference. The President and the Vice President. The President was seated in a classroom when, at 9:05, Andrew Card whispered to him, "A second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack." The President told us his instinct was to project calm, not to have the country see an excited reaction at a moment of crisis. The press was standing behind the children. He saw their phones and pagers start to ring. The president felt he should project strength and calm until he could better understand what was happening. The president remained in the classroom for another 5 to 7 minutes while the children continued reading. He then returned to a holding room shortly before 9:15, where he was briefed by staff and saw television coverage. He next spoke to Vice President Cheney, Dr. Rice, New York Governor George Pataki, and FBI Director Robert Mueller. He decided to make a brief statement from the school before leaving for the airport. The Secret Service told us they were anxious to move the president to a safer location, but did not think it imperative for him to run out the door. Between 9:15 and 9:30, the staff was busy arranging a return to Washington while the president consulted his senior advisors about his remarks. No one in the traveling party had any information during this time that other aircraft were hijacked or missing. Staff was in contact with the White House Situation Room, but as far as we could determine, no one with the president was in contact with the Pentagon. The focus was on the president's statement to the nation. The only decision made during this time was to return to Washington. The president's motorcade departed at 9:35 and arrived at the airport between 9:42 and 9:45. During the ride, the president learned about the attack on the Pentagon. He boarded the aircraft, asked the Secret Service about the safety of his family, and called the vice president. According to notes of the call, at about 9:45, the president told the vice president, "Sounds like we have a minor war going on here. I heard about the Pentagon. We're at war. Somebody's going to pay." About this time, Card, the lead Secret Service agent, the president's military aide, and the pilot were conferring on a possible destination for Air Force One. The Secret Service agent felt strongly that the situation in Washington was too unstable for the president to return there, and Card agreed. The president strongly wanted to return to Washington, and only grudgingly agreed to go elsewhere. The issue was still undecided when the president conferred with the vice president at about the time Air Force One was taking off. The vice president recalled urging the president not to return to Washington. Air Force One departed at about 9:54 without any fixed destination. The objective was to get up in the air, as fast and as high as possible, and then decide where to go. At 9:33, the tower supervisor at Reagan National Airport picked up a hotline to the Secret Service and told the service's operations center that an aircraft is coming at you and not talking with us. This was the first specific report to the Secret Service of a direct threat to the White House. No move was made to evacuate the vice president at this time. As the officer who took the call explained, "I was about to push the alert button when the tower advised that the aircraft was turning south and approaching Reagan National Airport." American Flight No. 77 began turning south, away from the White House, at 9:34. It continued heading south for roughly a minute before turning west and beginning to circle back. This news prompted the Secret Service to order the immediate evacuation of the vice president just before 9:36. Agents propelled him out of his chair and told him he had to get to the bunker. The vice president entered the underground tunnel leading to the shelter at 9:37. Once inside, Vice President Cheney and the agents paused in an area of the tunnel that had a secure phone, a bench, and television. The vice president asked to speak to the president, but it took time for the call to be connected. He learned in the tunnel that the Pentagon had been hit, and he saw television coverage of smoke coming from the building. The Secret Service logged Mrs. Cheney's arrival at the White House at 9:52, and she joined her husband in the tunnel. According to contemporaneous notes, at 9:55, the vice president was still on the phone with the president, advising that three planes were missing and one had hit the Pentagon. We believe this is the same call in which the vice president urged the president not to return to Washington. After the call ended, Mrs. Cheney and the vice president moved from the tunnel to the shelter conference room. United 93 and the shoot-down order. On the morning of 9/11, the president and vice president stayed in contact not by an open line of communication, but through a series of calls. The president told us he was frustrated with the poor communications that morning. He could not reach key officials, including Secretary Rumsfeld, for a period of time. The line to the White House shelter conference room and the vice president kept cutting off. The vice president remembered placing a call to the president just after entering the shelter conference room. There is conflicting evidence about when the vice president arrived in the shelter conference room. We have concluded from the available evidence that the vice president arrived in the room shortly before 10, perhaps at 9:58. The vice president recalled being told, just after his arrival, that the Air Force was trying to establish a combat air patrol over Washington. The vice president stated that he called the president to discuss the rules of engagement for the CAP. He recalled feeling that it did no good to establish the CAP unless the pilots had instructions on whether they were authorized to shoot if the plane would not divert. He said the president signed off on that concept. The president said he remembered such a conversation and that it reminded him of when he had been an interceptor pilot. The president emphasized to us that he had authorized the shoot-down of hijacked aircraft. The vice president's military aide told us he believed the vice president spoke to the president just after entering the conference room, but he did not hear what they said. Rice, who entered the room shortly after the vice president and sat next to him, remembered hearing him inform the president, "Sir, the caps are up. Sir, they're going to want to know what to do." Then she recalled hearing him say, "Yes, sir." She believed this conversation occurred a few minutes, perhaps five, after they entered the conference room. We believe this call would have taken place before 10:10 to 10:15. Among the sources that reflect other important events of that morning, there is no documentary evidence for this call, but the relevant sources are incomplete. Others nearby who were taking notes, such as Vice President's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, who sat next to him, and Mrs. Cheney, did not note a call between the President and Vice President immediately after the Vice President entered the conference room. At 10:02, the communications in the shelter began receiving reports from the Secret Service of an inbound aircraft, presumably hijacked, heading toward Washington. The aircraft was United Flight No. 93. The Secret Service was getting this information directly from the FAA. The FAA may have been tracking the progress of United 93 on a display that showed its projected path to Washington, not its actual radar return. Thus, the Secret Service was relying on projections and was not aware the plane was already down in Pennsylvania. At some time between 10:10 and 10:15, a military aide told the Vice President and others that the aircraft was 80 miles out. Vice President Cheney was asked for authority to engage the aircraft. His reaction was described by Scooter Libby as quick and decisive, in about the time it takes a batter to decide to swing. The vice president authorized fighter aircraft to engage the inbound plane. He told us he based this authorization on his earlier conversation with the president. The military aide returned a few minutes later, probably between 10:12 and 10:18, and said the aircraft was 60 miles out. He again asked for authorization to engage. The vice president again said yes. At the conference room table was White House Deputy Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton. Bolton watched the exchanges and, after what he called a quiet moment, suggested that the vice president get in touch with the president and confirm the engage order. Bolton told us he wanted to make sure the president was told that the vice president had executed the order. He said he had not heard any prior discussion on the subject with the president. The vice president was logged calling the president at 10:18 for a two-minute conversation that obtained the confirmation. On Air Force One, the president's press secretary was taking notes. Ari Fleischer recorded that at 10:20, the president told him that he had authorized a shoot-down of aircraft if necessary. Minutes went by, and word arrived of an aircraft down in Pennsylvania. Those in the shelter wondered if the aircraft had been shot down pursuant to the authorization. At approximately 10:30, the shelter started receiving reports of another hijacked plane, this time only 5 to 10 miles out. Believing they had only a minute or two, the vice president again communicated the authorization to engage or take out the aircraft. At 10:33, Hadley told the Air Threat Conference call, I need to get word to Dick Myers that our reports are there's an inbound aircraft flying low, 5 miles out. The Vice President's guidance was we need to take them out. Once again, there was no immediate information about the fate of the inbound aircraft. In the apt description of one witness, it drops below the radar screen, and it's just continually hovering in your imagination. You don't know where it is or what happens to it. Eventually, the shelter received word that the alleged hijacker, 5 miles away, had been a medevac helicopter. Transmission of the authorization from the White House to the pilots. The NMCC learned of United Flight 93's hijacking at about 10:03. At this time, the FAA had no contact with the military at the level of national command. The NMCC learned about United No. 93 from the White House. In turn, it was informed by the Secret Service's contacts with the FAA. NORAD had no information either. At 10:07, its representative on the Air Threat Conference call stated that NORAD had no indication of a hijack heading to D.C. at this time. Repeatedly, between 10:14 and 10:19, a lieutenant colonel at the White House relayed to the NMCC that the vice president had confirmed fighters were cleared to engage inbound aircraft if they could verify that the aircraft was hijacked. The commander of NORAD, General Ralph Eberhardt, was en route to the NORAD Operations Center in Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado, when the shoot-down order was communicated on the Air Threat Conference call. He told us that by the time he arrived, the order had already been passed down NORAD's chain of command. It is not clear how the shoot-down order was communicated within NORAD, but we know that at 10:31, General Larry Arnold instructed his staff to broadcast the following over a NORAD instant messaging system. 10:31, Vice President has cleared us to intercept tracts of interest and shoot them down if they do not respond per General Arnold. In upstate New York, NEAD's personnel first learned of the shoot-down order from this message. Floor leadership, you need to read this. The region commander has declared that we can shoot down aircraft that do not respond to our direction. Copy that? Controllers, copy that, sir. Floor leadership, so if you're trying to divert somebody and he won't divert, controllers. DO, Director of Operations, is saying no. Floor leadership, no. It came over the chat. You got a conflict on that direction? Controllers, right now, no, but floor leadership. Okay? Okay, you read that from the Vice President, right? Vice President has cleared. Vice President has cleared us to intercept traffic and shoot them down if they do not respond per General Arnold. In interviews with us, NEAD's personnel expressed considerable confusion over the nature and effect of the order. The NEAD's commander told us he did not pass along the order because he was unaware of its ramifications. Both the mission commander and the senior weapons director indicated that they did not pass the order to the fighters circling Washington and New York because they were unsure how the pilots would or should proceed with this guidance. In short, while leaders in Washington believed that the fighters above them had been instructed to take out hostile aircraft, the only orders actually conveyed to the pilots were to ID type and tail. In most cases, the chain of command authorizing the use of force runs from the President to the Secretary of Defense and from the Secretary to the combat commander. The President apparently spoke to Secretary Rumsfeld for the first time that morning shortly after 10 o'clock. No one can recall the content of this conversation, but it was a brief call in which the subject of shoot-down authority was not discussed. At 10:39, the Vice President updated the Secretary on the Air Threat Conference. Vice President, there's been at least 3 instances here where we've had reports of aircraft approaching Washington. A couple were confirmed hijack, and pursuant to the President's instruction, I gave authorization for them to be taken out. Hello? Secretary of Defense, yes, I understand. Who did you give that direction to? Vice President, it was passed from here through the Operations Center at the White House from the shelter. Secretary of Defense, okay, let me ask the question here. Has that directive been transmitted to the aircraft? Vice President, yes, it has. Secretary of Defense, So we've got a couple of aircraft up there that have those instructions at this present time? Vice President. That is correct, and it's my understanding they've already taken a couple of aircraft out. Secretary of Defense. We can't confirm that. We're told that one aircraft is down, but we do not have a pilot report that did it. As this exchange shows, Secretary Rumsfeld was not in the NMCC when the shoot-down order was first conveyed. He went from the parking lot to his office, where he spoke to the president, then to the Executive Support Center, where he participated in the White House video teleconference. He moved to the NMCC shortly before 10:30 in order to join Vice Chairman Myers. Secretary Rumsfeld told us he was just gaining situational awareness when he spoke with the Vice President at 10:39. His primary concern was ensuring that the pilots had a clear understanding of their rules of engagement. The Vice President was mistaken in his belief that shoot-down authorization had been passed to the pilots flying at NORAD's direction. By 10:45, there was, however, another set of fighters circling Washington that had entirely different rules of engagement. These fighters, part of the 113th Wing of the District of Columbia Air National Guard, launched out of Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland in response to information passed to them by the Secret Service. The first of the Andrews fighters was airborne at 10:38. General David Worley, the commander of the 113th Wing, reached out to the Secret Service after hearing second-hand reports that it wanted fighters airborne. A Secret Service agent had a phone in each ear, one connected to Worley and the other to a fellow agent at the White House, relaying instructions that the White House agent said he was getting from the Vice President. The guidance for Worley was to send up the aircraft, with orders to protect the White House, and take out any aircraft that threatened the Capitol. General Worley translated this in military terms to flying weapons-free. That is, the decision to shoot rests in the cockpit, or in this case, in the cockpit of the lead pilot. He passed these instructions to the pilots that launched at 10:42 and afterward. Thus, while the fighter pilots under NORAD direction, who had scrambled out of Langley, never received any type of engagement order, the Andrews pilots were operating weapons-free, a permissive rule of engagement. The President and the Vice President indicated to us they had not been aware that fighters had been scrambled out of Andrews at the request of the Secret Service and outside the military chain of command. There is no evidence that NORAD headquarters or military officials in the NMCC knew, during the morning of September 11, that the Andrews planes were airborne and operating under different rules of engagement. What if? NORAD officials have maintained consistently that had the passengers not caused United Flight No. 93 to crash, the military would have prevented it from reaching Washington, D.C. That conclusion is based on a version of events that we now know is incorrect. The Langley fighters were not scrambled in response to United No. 93. NORAD did not have 47 minutes to intercept the flight. NORAD did not even know the plane was hijacked until after it had crashed. It is appropriate, therefore, to reconsider whether United 93 would have been intercepted. Had it not crashed in Pennsylvania at 10:03, we estimate that United Flight No. 93 could not have reached Washington any earlier than 10:13, and probably would have arrived before 10:23. There was only one set of fighters circling Washington during that time frame, the Langley F-16s. They were armed and under NORAD's control. After NEADS learned of the hijacking at 10:07, NORAD would have had from 6 to 16 minutes to locate the flight, receive authorization to shoot it down, and communicate the order to the pilots, who, in the same span, would have had to authenticate the order, intercept the flight, and execute the order. At that point in time, the Langley pilots did not know the threat they were facing. They did not know where United No. 93 was located and did not have shoot-down authorization. First, the Langley pilots were never briefed about the reason they were scrambled. As the lead pilot explained, "I reverted to the Russian threat. I'm thinking cruise missile threat from the sea. You know, you look down and see the Pentagon burning, and I thought the bastard snuck one by us. You couldn't see any airplanes, and no one told us anything. The pilots knew their mission was to divert aircraft, but did not know that the threat came from hijacked airliners. Second, NEADS did not have accurate information on the location of United Flight Number 93. Presumably, FAA would have provided such information, but we do not know how long that would have taken, nor how long it would have taken NEADS to locate the target. Third, NEADS needed orders to pass to the pilots. At 10:10, the pilots over Washington were emphatically told, "Negative clearance to shoot." Shoot-down authority was first communicated to NEADS at 10:31. It is possible that NORAD commanders would have ordered a shoot-down in the absence of the authorization communicated by the Vice President, but given the gravity of the decision to shoot down a commercial airliner, and NORAD's caution that a mistake not be made, we view this possibility as unlikely. NORAD officials have maintained that they would have intercepted and shot down United Flight Number 93. We are not so sure. We are sure that the nation owes a debt to the passengers of United Flight Number 93. Their actions saved the lives of countless others and may have saved either the Capitol or the White House from destruction. The details of what happened on the morning of September 11 are complex, but they play out a simple theme. NORAD and the FAA were unprepared for the type of attacks launched against the United States on September 11, 2001. They struggled under difficult circumstances to improve a homeland defense against an unprecedented challenge they had never before encountered and had never trained to meet. At 10:02 that morning, an assistant to the mission crew commander at NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector in Rome, New York, was working with his colleagues on the floor of the command center. In a brief moment of reflection, he was recorded remarking that, "This is a new type of war." He was, and is, right. But the conflict did not begin on 9/11. It had been publicly declared years earlier, most notably in a declaration faxed early in 1998 to an Arabic-language newspaper in London. Few Americans had noticed it. The fax had been sent from thousands of miles away by the followers of a Saudi exile gathered in one of the most remote and impoverished countries on earth. Chapter 2. The Foundation of the New Terrorism. Section 2.1. A Declaration of War. In February 1998, the 40-year-old Saudi exile Osama bin Laden and a fugitive Egyptian physician, Ayman al-Zawahiri, arranged from their Afghan headquarters for an Arabic newspaper in London to publish what they termed a fatwa, issued in the name of a World Islamic Front. A fatwa is normally an interpretation of Islamic law by a respected Islamic authority. But neither bin Laden, Zawahiri, nor the three others who signed this statement were scholars of Islamic law. Claiming that America had declared war against God and His Messenger, they called for the murder of any American anywhere on earth as the individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. 3 months later, when interviewed in Afghanistan by ABC TV, bin Laden enlarged on these themes. He claimed it was more important for Muslims to kill Americans than to kill other infidels. "It is far better for anyone to kill a single American soldier than to squander his efforts on other activities," he said. Asked whether he approved of terrorism and of attacks on civilians, he replied, "We believe that the worst thieves in the world today and the worst terrorists are the Americans. Nothing could stop you except perhaps retaliation in kind. We do not have to differentiate between military or civilian. As far as we are concerned, they are all targets." Though novel for its open endorsement of indiscriminate killing, Bin Laden's 1998 declaration was only the latest in the long series of his public and private calls since 1992 that singled out the United States for attack. In August 1996, Bin Laden had issued his own self-styled fatwa, calling on Muslims to drive American soldiers out of Saudi Arabia. The long, disjointed document condemned the Saudi monarchy for allowing the presence of an army of infidels in a land with the sites most sacred to Islam, and celebrated recent suicide bombings of American military facilities in the kingdom. It praised the 1983 suicide bombing in Beirut that killed 241 U.S. Marines, the 1992 bombing in Aden, and especially the 1993 firefight in Somalia, after which the United States left the area carrying disappointment, humiliation, defeat, and your dead with you. Bin Laden said in his ABC interview that he and his followers had been preparing in Somalia for another long struggle, like that against the Soviets in Afghanistan, but the United States rushed out of Somalia in shame and disgrace. Citing the Soviet army's withdrawal from Afghanistan as proof that a ragged army of dedicated Muslims could overcome a superpower, he told the interviewer, "We are certain that we shall, with the grace of Allah, prevail over the Americans." He went on to warn that, "If the present injustice continues, it will inevitably move the battle to American soil." Plans to attack the United States were developed with unwavering single-mindedness throughout the 1990s. Bin Laden saw himself as called to follow in the footsteps of the messenger and to communicate his message to all nations, and to serve as the rallying point and organizer of a new kind of war to destroy America and bring the world to Islam. Section 2.2. Bin Laden's appeal in the Islamic world. It is the story of eccentric and violent ideas sprouting in the fertile ground of political and social turmoil. It is the story of an organization poised to seize its historical moment. How did Bin Laden, with his call for the indiscriminate killing of Americans, win thousands of followers and some degree of approval from millions more? The history, culture, and body of beliefs from which Bin Laden has shaped and spread his message are largely unknown to many Americans. Seizing on symbols of Islam's past greatness, he promises to restore pride to people who consider themselves the victims of successive foreign masters. He uses cultural and religious allusions to the Holy Quran and some of its interpreters. He appeals to people disoriented by cyclonic change as they confront modernity and globalization. His rhetoric selectively draws from multiple sources: Islam, history, and the region's political and economic malaise. He also stresses grievances against the United States, widely shared in the Muslim world. He inveighed against the presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, the home of Islam's holiest sites. He spoke of the suffering of the Iraqi people as a result of the sanctions imposed after the Gulf War, and he protested U.S. support of Israel. Islam. Islam, a word that literally means surrender to the will of God, arose in Arabia with what Muslims believe are a series of revelations to the Prophet Muhammad from the one and only God, the God of Abraham and of Jesus. These revelations, conveyed by the angel Gabriel, are recorded in the Quran. Muslims believe that these revelations, given to the greatest and last of a chain of prophets, stretching from Abraham through Jesus, complete God's message to humanity. The Hadith, which recount Muhammad's sayings and deeds as recorded by his contemporaries, are another fundamental source. A third key element is the Sharia, the code of law derived from the Quran and the Hadith. Islam is divided into two main branches, Sunni and Shia. Soon after the Prophet's death, the question of choosing a new leader, or caliph, for the Muslim community, or Ummah, arose. Initially, his successors could be drawn from the Prophet's contemporaries, but with time, this was no longer possible. Those who became the Shia held that any leader of the Ummah must be a direct descendant of the Prophet. Those who became the Sunni argued that lineal descent was not required if the candidate met other standards of faith and knowledge. After bloody struggles, the Sunni became, and remain, the majority sect. The Shia are dominant in Iran. The Caliphate, the institutionalized leadership of the Ummah, thus was a Sunni institution that continued until 1924, first under Arab and eventually under Ottoman Turkish control. Many Muslims look back at the century after the revelation to the Prophet Muhammad as a golden age. Its memory is strongest among the Arabs. What happened then, the spread of Islam from the Arabian Peninsula throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and even into Europe within less than a century, seemed, and seems, miraculous. Nostalgia for Islam's past glory remains a powerful force. Islam is both a faith and a code of conduct for all aspects of life. For many Muslims, a good government would be one guided by the moral principles of their faith. This does not necessarily translate into a desire for clerical rule and the abolition of a secular state. It does mean that some Muslims tend to be uncomfortable with distinctions between religion and state, though Muslim rulers throughout history have readily separated the two. To extremists, however, such divisions, as well as the existence of parliaments and legislation, only prove these rulers to be false Muslims, usurping God's authority over all aspects of life. Periodically, the Islamic world has seen surges of what, for want of a better term, is often labeled fundamentalism. Denouncing waywardness among the faithful, some clerics have appealed for a return to observance of the literal teachings of the Quran and Hadith. One scholar from the 14th century, from whom bin Laden selectively quotes, Ibn Taymiyyah, condemned both corrupt rulers and the clerics who failed to criticize them. He urged Muslims to read the Quran and the Hadith for themselves, not to depend solely on learned interpreters like himself, but to hold one another to account for the quality of their observance. The extreme Islamist version of history blames the decline from Islam's golden age on the rulers and people who turned away from the true path of their religion, thereby leaving Islam vulnerable to encroaching foreign powers eager to steal their land, wealth, and even their souls. Bin Laden's worldview. Despite his claims to universal leadership, bin Laden offers an extreme view of Islamic history designed to appeal mainly to Arabs and Sunnis. He draws on fundamentalists who blame the eventual destruction of the caliphate on leaders who abandoned the pure path of religious devotion. He repeatedly calls on his followers to embrace martyrdom, since the walls of oppression and humiliation cannot be demolished except in a rain of bullets. For those yearning for a lost sense of order in an older, more tranquil world, he offers his caliphate as an imagined alternative to today's uncertainty. For others, he offers simplistic conspiracies to explain their world. Bin Laden also relies heavily on the Egyptian writer Sayyid Qutb. A member of the Muslim Brotherhood, executed in 1966 on charges of attempting to overthrow the government, Qutb mixed Islamic scholarship with a very superficial acquaintance with Western history and thought. Sent by the Egyptian government to study in the United States in the late 1940s, Qutb returned with an enormous loathing of Western society and history. He dismissed Western achievements as entirely material, arguing that Western society possesses nothing that will satisfy its own conscience and justify its existence. Three basic themes emerge from Qutb's writings. First, he claimed that the world was beset with barbarism, licentiousness, and unbelief, a condition he called jahiliya, the religious term for the period of ignorance prior to the revelations given to the Prophet Muhammad. Qutb argued that humans can choose only between Islam and Jahiliyyah, Second, he warned that more people, including Muslims, were attracted to Jahiliyyah and its material comforts than to his view of Islam. Jahiliyyah could therefore triumph over Islam. Third, no middle ground exists in what Qutb conceived as a struggle between God and Satan. All Muslims, as he defined them, therefore must take up arms in this fight. Any Muslim who rejects his ideas is just one more non-believer worthy of destruction. Bin Laden shares Qutb's stark view, permitting him and his followers to rationalize even unprovoked mass murder as righteous defense of an embattled faith. Many Americans have wondered, why do they hate us? Some also ask, what can we do to stop these attacks? Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have given answers to both these questions. To the first, they say that America had attacked Islam. America is responsible for all conflicts involving Muslims. Thus, Americans are blamed when Israelis fight with Palestinians, when Russians fight with Chechens, when Indians fight with Kashmiri Muslims, and when the Philippine government fights ethnic Muslims in its southern islands. America is also held responsible for the governments of Muslim countries, derided by Al-Qaeda as your agents. Bin Laden has stated flatly, "Our fight against these governments is not separate from our fight against you." These charges found a ready audience among millions of Arabs and Muslims angry at the United States because of issues ranging from Iraq to Palestine to America's support for their country's repressive rulers. Bin Laden's grievance with the United States may have started in reaction to specific U.S. policies, but it quickly became far deeper. To the second question, what America could do, Al-Qaeda's answer was that America should abandon the Middle East, convert to Islam, and end the immorality and godlessness of its society and culture. It is saddening to tell you that you are the worst civilization witnessed by the history of mankind. If the United States did not comply, it would be at war with the Islamic nation, a nation that Al-Qaeda's leaders said desires death more than you desire life. History and political context. Few fundamentalist movements in the Islamic world gained lasting political power. In the 19th and 20th centuries, fundamentalists helped articulate anti-colonial grievances but played little role in the overwhelmingly secular struggles for independence after World War I. Western-educated lawyers, soldiers, and officials led most independence movements, and clerical influence and traditional culture were seen as obstacles to national progress. After gaining independence from Western powers following World War II, the Arab Middle East followed an arc from initial pride and optimism to today's mix of indifference, cynicism, and despair. In several countries, a dynastic state already existed or was quickly established under a paramount tribal family. Monarchies in countries such as Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and Jordan still survive today. Those in Egypt, Libya, Iraq, and Yemen were eventually overthrown by secular nationalist revolutionaries. The secular regimes promised a glowing future, often tied to sweeping ideologies, such as those promoted by Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser's Arab Socialism, or the Ba'ath Party of Syria and Iraq, that called for a single secular Arab state. However, what emerged were almost invariably autocratic regimes that were usually unwilling to tolerate any opposition, even in countries such as Egypt that had a parliamentary tradition. Over time, their policies, repression, rewards, immigration, and the displacement of popular anger onto scapegoats, generally foreign, were shaped by the desire to cling to power. The bankruptcy of secular autocratic nationalism was evident across the Muslim world by the late 1970s. At the same time, these regimes had closed off nearly all paths for peaceful opposition, forcing their critics to choose silence, exile, or violent opposition. Iran's 1979 revolution swept a Shia theocracy into power. Its success encouraged Sunni fundamentalists elsewhere. In the 1980s, awash in sudden oil wealth, Saudi Arabia competed with Shia Iran to promote its Sunni fundamentalist interpretation of Islam, Wahhabism. The Saudi government, always conscious of its duties as the custodian of Islam's holiest places, joined with wealthy Arabs from the kingdom and other states bordering the Persian Gulf in donating money to build mosques and religious schools that could preach and teach their interpretation of Islamic doctrine. In this competition for legitimacy, secular regimes had no alternative to offer. Instead, in a number of cases, their rulers sought to buy off local Islamist movements by ceding control of many social and educational issues. Emboldened rather than satisfied, the Islamists continued to push for power, a trend especially clear in Egypt. Confronted with a violent Islamist movement that killed President Anwar Sadat in 1981, the Egyptian government combined harsh repression of Islamic militants with harassment of moderate Islamic scholars and authors, driving many into exile. In Pakistan, a military regime sought to justify its seizure of power by a pious public stance and an embrace of unprecedented Islamist influence on education and society. These experiments in political Islam faltered during the 1990s. The Iranian revolution lost momentum, prestige, and public support, and Pakistan's rulers found that most of its population had little enthusiasm for fundamentalist Islam. Islamist revival movements gained followers across the Muslim world but failed to secure political power, except in Iran and Sudan. In Algeria, where in 1991 Islamists seemed almost certain to win power through the ballot box, the military preempted their victory, triggering a brutal civil war that continues today. Opponents of today's rulers have few, if any, ways to participate in the existing political system. They are thus a ready audience for calls to Muslims to purify their society, reject unwelcome modernization, and adhere strictly to the Sharia. Social and economic malaise. In the 1970s and early 1980s, an unprecedented flood of wealth led the then largely unmodernized oil states to attempt to shortcut decades of development. They funded huge infrastructure projects, vastly expanded education, and created subsidized social welfare programs. These programs established a widespread feeling of entitlement without a corresponding sense of social obligations. By the late 1980s, diminishing oil revenues, the economic drain from many unprofitable development projects, and population growth made these entitlement programs unsustainable. The resulting cutbacks created enormous resentment among recipients who had come to see government largesse as their right. This resentment was further stoked by public understanding of how much oil income had gone straight into the pockets of the rulers, their friends, and their helpers. Unlike the oil states, or Afghanistan, where real economic development has barely begun, the other Arab nations and Pakistan once had seemed headed toward balanced modernization. The established commercial, financial, and industrial sectors in these states, supported by an entrepreneurial spirit and widespread understanding of free enterprise, augured well. But unprofitable heavy industry, state monopolies, and opaque bureaucracies slowly stifled growth. More importantly, these state-centered regimes placed their highest priority on preserving the elite's grip on national wealth. Unwilling to foster dynamic economies that could create jobs attractive to educate young men, the countries became economically stagnant and reliant on the safety valve of worker immigration, either to the Arab oil states or to the West. Furthermore, the repression and isolation of women in many Muslim countries have not only seriously limited individual opportunity, but also crippled overall economic productivity. By the 1990s, high birth rates and declining rates of infant mortality had produced a common problem throughout the Muslim world. A large, steadily increasing population of young men without any reasonable expectation of suitable or steady employment. A sure prescription for social turbulence. Many of these young men, such as the enormous number trained only in religious schools, lacked the skills needed by their societies. Far more acquired valuable skills, but lived in stagnant economies that could not generate satisfying jobs. Millions pursuing secular as well as religious studies were products of educational systems that generally devoted little, if any, attention to the rest of the world's thought, history, and culture. The secular education reflected a strong cultural preference for technical fields over the humanities and social sciences. Many of these young men, even if able to study abroad, lacked the perspective and skills needed to understand a different culture. Frustrated in their search for a decent living, unable to benefit from an education often obtained at the cost of great family sacrifice, and blocked from starting families of their own, some of these young men were easy targets for radicalization. Bin Laden's historical opportunity. Most Muslims prefer a peaceful and inclusive vision of their faith, not the violent sectarianism of Bin Laden. Among Arabs, Bin Laden's followers are commonly nicknamed Takfiri, or those who define other Muslims as unbelievers, because of their readiness to demonize and murder those with whom they disagree. Beyond the theology lies the simple human fact that most Muslims, like most other human beings, are repelled by mass murder and barbarism, whatever their justification. All Americans must recognize that the face of terror is not the true face of Islam, President Bush observed. Islam is a faith that brings comfort to a billion people around the world. It's a faith that has made brothers and sisters of every race. It's a faith based upon love, not hate. Yet as political, social, and economic problems created flammable societies, Bin Laden used Islam's most extreme fundamentalist traditions as his match. All these elements, including religion, combined in an explosive compound. Other extremists had and have followings of their own, but in appealing to societies full of discontent, Bin Laden remained credible as other leaders and symbols faded. He could stand as a symbol of resistance, above all resistance to the West and to America. He could present himself and his allies as victorious warriors in the one great successful experience for Islamic militancy in the 1980s, the Afghan Jihad against the Soviet occupation. By 1998, Bin Laden had a distinctive appeal as he focused on attacking America. He argued that other extremists who aimed at local rulers or Israel did not go far enough. They had not taken on what he called the head of the snake. Finally, Bin Laden had another advantage, a substantial worldwide organization. By the time he issued his February 1998 declaration of war, Bin Laden had nurtured that organization for nearly 10 years. He could attract, train, and use recruits for ever more ambitious attacks, rallying new adherents with each demonstration that his was the movement of the future. Section 2.3. The Rise of Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. A decade of conflict in Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989 gave Islamist extremists a rallying point and training field. A communist government in Afghanistan gained power in 1978, but was unable to establish enduring control. At the end of 1979, the Soviet government sent in military units to ensure that the country would remain securely under Moscow's influence. The response was an Afghan national resistance movement that defeated Soviet forces. Young Muslims from around the world flocked to Afghanistan to join as volunteers in what was seen as a holy war, jihad, against an invader. The largest numbers came from the Middle East. Some were Saudis, and among them was Osama bin Laden. 23 when he arrived in Afghanistan in 1980, bin Laden was the 17th of 57 children of a Saudi construction magnate. 6 feet five and thin, bin Laden appeared to be ungainly, but was in fact quite athletic, skilled as a horseman, runner, climber, and soccer player. He had attended Abdulaziz University in Saudi Arabia. By some accounts, he had been interested there in religious studies, inspired by tape recordings of fiery sermons by Abdullah Azam, a Palestinian and a disciple of Qutb. Bin Laden was conspicuous among the volunteers not because he showed evidence of religious learning, but because he had access to some of his family's huge fortune. Though he took part in at least one actual battle, he became known chiefly as a person who generously helped fund the anti-Soviet jihad. Bin Laden understood better than most of the volunteers the extent to which the continuation and eventual success of the jihad in Afghanistan depended on an increasingly complex, almost worldwide organization. This organization included a financial support network that came to be known as the Golden Chain, put together mainly by financiers in Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf states. Donations flowed through charities or other non-governmental organizations, NGOs. Bin Laden and the Afghan Arabs drew largely on funds raised by this network, whose agents roamed world markets to buy arms and supplies for the Mujahideen, or Holy Warriors. Mosques, schools, and boarding houses served as recruiting stations in many parts of the world, including the United States. Some were set up by Islamic extremists or their financial backers. Bin Laden had an important part in this activity. He and the cleric Azam had joined in creating a Bureau of Services, Maktab al-Khidmat, or MAK, which channeled recruits into Afghanistan. The international environment for bin Laden's efforts was ideal. Saudi Arabia and the United States supplied billions of dollars worth of secret assistance to rebel groups in Afghanistan fighting the Soviet occupation. This assistance was funneled through Pakistan. The Pakistani Military Intelligence Service, Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, or ISID, helped train the rebels and distribute the arms. But bin Laden and his comrades had their own sources of support and training, and they received little or no assistance from the United States. April 1988 brought victory for the Afghan jihad. Moscow declared it would pull its military forces out of Afghanistan within the next 9 months. As the Soviets began their withdrawal, the jihad's leaders debated what to do next. Bin Laden and Azam agreed that the organization successfully created for Afghanistan should not be allowed to dissolve. They established what they called a base or foundation, Al-Qaeda, as a potential general headquarters for future jihad. Though Azam had been considered number one in the MAK, by August 1988, bin Laden was clearly the leader, or emir, of Al-Qaeda. This organization's structure included as its operating arms an intelligence component, a military committee, a financial committee, a political committee, and a committee in charge of media affairs and propaganda. It also had an advisory council, Shura, made up of bin Laden's inner circle. Bin Laden's assumption of the helm of Al-Qaeda was evidence of his growing self-confidence and ambition. He soon made clear his desire for unchallenged control and for preparing the Mujahideen to fight anywhere in the world. Azam, by contrast, favored continuing to fight in Afghanistan until it held a true Islamist government. And as a Palestinian, he saw Israel as the top priority for the next stage. Whether the dispute was about power, personal differences, or strategy, it ended on November the 24th, 1989, when a remotely controlled car bomb killed Azam and both of his sons. The killers were assumed to be rival Egyptians. The outcome left bin Laden indisputably in charge of what remained of the MAK and Al-Qaeda. Through writers like Qutb and the presence of Egyptian Islamist teachers in the Saudi educational system, Islamists already had a strong intellectual influence on bin Laden and his al-Qaeda colleagues. By the late 1980s, the Egyptian Islamist movement, badly battered in the government crackdown following President Sadat's assassination, was centered in two major organizations, the Islamic Group and the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. A spiritual guide for both, but especially the Islamic Group, was the so-called Blind Sheikh, Omar Abdel Rahman. His preaching had inspired the assassination of Sadat. After being in and out of Egyptian prisons during the 1980s, Abdel Rahman found refuge in the United States. From his headquarters in Jersey City, he distributed messages calling for the murder of unbelievers. The most important Egyptian in bin Laden's circle was a surgeon, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who led a strong faction of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Many of his followers became important members in the new organization, and his own close ties with bin Laden led many to think of him as the deputy head of al-Qaeda. He would, in fact, become bin Laden's deputy some years later when they merged their organizations. Bin Laden moves to Sudan. By the fall of 1989, bin Laden had sufficient stature among Islamic extremists that a Sudanese political leader, Hassan al-Turabi, urged him to transplant his whole organization to Sudan. Turabi headed the National Islamic Front in a coalition that had recently seized power in Khartoum. Bin Laden agreed to help Turabi in an ongoing war against African Christian separatists in southern Sudan, and also to do some road building. Turabi, in return, would let bin Laden use Sudan as a base for worldwide business operations and for preparations for jihad. While agents of bin Laden began to buy property in Sudan in 1990, bin Laden himself moved from Afghanistan back to Saudi Arabia. In August 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. Bin Laden, whose efforts in Afghanistan had earned him celebrity and respect, proposed to the Saudi monarchy that he summon Mujahideen for a jihad to retake Kuwait. He was rebuffed, and the Saudis joined the U.S.-led coalition. After the Saudis agreed to allow U.S. armed forces to be based in the kingdom, bin Laden and a number of Islamic clerics began to publicly denounce the arrangement. The Saudi government exiled the clerics and undertook to silence bin Laden by, among other things, taking away his passport. With help from a dissident member of the royal family, he managed to get out of the country under the pretext of attending an Islamic gathering in Pakistan in April 1991. By 1994, the Saudi government would freeze his financial assets and revoke his citizenship. He no longer had a country he could call his own. Bin Laden moved to Sudan in 1991 and set up a large and complex set of intertwined business and terrorist enterprises. In time, the former would encompass numerous companies and a global network of bank accounts and non-governmental institutions. Fulfilling his bargain with Turabi, bin Laden used his construction company to build a new highway from Khartoum to Port Sudan on the Red Sea coast. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda finance officers and top operatives used their positions in bin Laden's businesses to acquire weapons, explosives, and technical equipment for terrorist purposes. One founding member, Abu Hajar al-Iraqi, used his position as head of bin Laden Investment Company to carry out procurement trips from Western Europe to the Far East. Two others, Wadi al-Haga and Mubarak Duari, who had become acquainted in Tucson, Arizona in the late 1980s, went as far afield as China, Malaysia, the Philippines, and the former Soviet states of Ukraine and Belarus. Bin Laden's impressive array of offices covertly provided financial and other support for terrorist activities. The network included a major business enterprise in Cyprus, a services branch in Zagreb, an office of the Benevolence International Foundation in Sarajevo, which supported the Bosnian Muslims in their conflict with Serbia and Croatia, and an NGO in Baku, Azerbaijan, that was employed as well by Egyptian Islamic Jihad, both as a source and conduit for finances, and as a support center for the Muslim rebels in Chechnya. He also made use of the already established Third World Relief Agency, TWRA, headquartered in Vienna, whose branch office locations included Zagreb and Budapest. Bin Laden later set up an NGO in Nairobi as a cover for operatives there. Bin Laden now had a vision of himself as head of an international jihad confederation. In Sudan, he established an Islamic Army Shura that was to serve as the coordinating body for the consortium of terrorist groups with which he was